I'm Shauna Meyerson with the Yoga for podcast. You're not Shauna with the Yoga of War podcast.
No, I'm Jonah on the Yoga of War podcast.
This is Jonah from the Being Jewish with Jonah Platt podcast with Jonah Platt.
That's right.
Not to be redundant or anything. But I, wow, this was an extra and unexpectedly jovial entry into what is not going to be the most jovial of conversations, to be honest. So
bringing it back.
Bringing it back. So since the Hamas massacre, how's that for toning it down a little? Yeah. I really work on like making these segues as smooth as possible. Since the Hamas terror massacre of 10/7/23, the world has seen a repugnant dynamic never seen before in history. Massive swaths of Western society disgracefully siding with terrorists and vilifying Israel for their own victimhood. But it didn't stop there. A vicious and violent wave of anti-Semitism not seen since World War II has swept the entire world. So-called social justice warriors started ripping down posters of Israeli babies and grandfathers taken brutally hostage by barbaric monsters and using anti-Zionism as a thinly veiled excuse for normalized Jew hatred. The influencers of Hollywood have remained basically silent. The Jews of Hollywood have remained shamefully silent, with the exception of a proud few. The Jews without trembling knees. And Jonah Platt has been right there at the front of the pack. A proud and vocal advocate for Israel and the Jewish people, Jonah launched the Being Jewish with Jonah Platt podcast to empower, educate, and explore issues affecting the Jewish community, both at home and abroad. Bucking the silence, Jonah has been an important voice in providing rational and relatable content to fight anti-Semitism and support the Jewish state in its just war on terror. Today, Jonah and I will discuss anti-Semitism, advocacy, and yes, being Jewish. If you happen to be a yogi or yogini who considers yourself anti-Israel or anti-Zionist, you owe it to yourself to listen to this discussion, understand the many forms that anti-Semitism takes, and how you can be part of the solution. In this yoga world, there is no place for hate. Jonah?
Hi.
Thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's been amazing, honestly, to watch your podcast unfold and how you have reached out to so many different sectors, honestly, of not just the Jewish population, but really the world. And I think that the world, one of the issues that people don't understand is that not just Israel fighting literally the world's war on terror, we'll put that aside, but anti-Semitism, this is not a Jewish problem. This is a societal problem.
Right.
And you've done an amazing job of reaching out to broader society to have people who are not necessarily Jewish, who are not necessarily having skin in the game, talking to this point. So can you tell me just a bit first about your podcast, which everyone should be subscribing to?
Thank you.
Find it in all the podcast places, and there will be links in the description.
Thank you.
Can you just tell me, like, how do you decide who's going to be on your show? And you've had just such an interesting and wide swath. What is the ultimate goal of the Being Jewish with Jonah Platt podcast?
Okay, so I'll answer the first part first, which is, like, how do I pick the guests? Like, who am I looking for? And the one baseline that all my guests have in common is that they all love and support Jews. So, like, my show is not the one where I'm bringing somebody on to fight about Israel. That's not what I'm interested in. There are plenty of places you can go for that. Mine is about celebrating and empowering and having important conversations that Jews and our non-Jewish allies need to all be having together. And then I'm looking for a diversity of profession, of gender, of skin color, of age. So I'm trying to have people from all over the spectrum. And so every episode should feel different than the one you just saw. Getting lots of different kinds of perspectives, because one of the goals, now segueing into goals, was to really showcase to people how diverse the spectrum of Jewish identity is. We as Jews so take it for granted that people know anything about Jews. They don't. Right. People don't know about Jews. I mean, we're so small. Most people on planet Earth will never meet a Jew as long as they live. And we sort of take that for granted here in America, where we're the second biggest Jewish population in the world.
By the way, 2% of the population.
Right. That's the second biggest population.
People think that we are...
People would guess like 40%.
Yes.
And we're 2%.
Growing up, I thought we were 1/3 of the world.
Right.
There was us, Muslims, Christians. We all have 1/3. Let's go our merry way.
Right.
We're 2%.
Right.
Sorry to interrupt.
No, not at all. I mean, we're less than 20 million people worldwide. So where was I?
So you were just saying how people don't understand, what is a Jew?
They don't know what a Jew is. They don't realize it can look all these different ways, and people connect to it at all these different touch points. So that's one of the goals. One of the other big goals of the show has been to empower people, Jews and non-Jews, to be proud of their identity, to speak up for their identity, to feel confident doing so because they have more knowledge and support. I also really I wanted to create a safe space for these guests, honestly, to be able to talk about this stuff, because, you know, these are notable professionals, and usually they're talking about their profession. They don't get to talk about this part of them, which is so important to them and such a part of who they are, but they don't, you know, when an actor is at a press junket, they're not asking about his Jewish identity. They're like, so tell me about the film.
Right.
So now I give someone the opportunity to really dig deep at what's it feel like to be an actor who's Jewish right now, and what does Judaism look like to you, and et cetera, et cetera. So that's
how do you define a Jew?
How do I define a Jew? I think the way I would define a Jew is anybody who has some sort of connection to the people, who themselves feel connected to and identify as Jewish. That's definition one. And then definition two, which is also a lot of Jews, is people who just happen to be ethnically Jewish, whether they give a shit about it or not. I mean, they're a Jew's a Jew. So, you
excuse
know.
The Yiddish.
Do we not curse on this show?
Well,
you want me to
it's a family show.
Okay. With,
you know, Jewish values, family values.
Yeah, we curse on my show. I don't know.
I know. Believe me, there's been plenty. I'm joking. There's been a lot of debate, honestly, about what is a Jew is, and this honestly is not just a theoretical debate. It has true legal repercussions, mm-hmm, right? Particularly when we're talking about Title VI violations, right? So only certain classes are protected,
right?
And the Jewish people. Like even rabbis, you can't get you can't get a consensus from Jews on anything. There's that.
It's tricky because, you know, we are sort of outside the typical construct of how we group people today, because we are this ancient tribe. I mean, you know, Asian Americans are not a tribe, but, you know, Black Americans are not a tribe.
Right.
Jews are literally a tribe who share all these different properties, you know. Homeland, language, religion, ethnic background, if we go back far enough. So what a Jew is anybody who's somehow a member of that tribe. And
right.
For some people, it's just through birth. For some people, it's by choice. And then, as you said, there's all these religious pieces that come into it. My view in terms of that is if you have any connection to being Jewish and you want to identify as a Jew, to me, you're a Jew. I don't care about the
right.
Patrilineal, matrilineal, sure. Grandparent, whatever. To me, it's we need to be bringing people in, not pushing people out.
I mean, honestly, I believe that way about all beliefs. Like, it doesn't matter what my mom believes. If I believe I'm Christian, I'm Christian, because a belief system is just that.
Well,
it's
that's what different.
You believe.
Judaism's not a belief system. Judaism is a peoplehood.
It has
an aspect. So, like, with Christianity, I can pick it up and put it down. If I believe in Jesus and accept him in my heart, I'm Christian. If I don't, I'm not Christian anymore. I can be a Jew and not believe a single thing about the Jewish religion.
And not even
or
believe
God.
In God.
Yeah.
Right.
And I'm still Jewish because it's a
sure.
People.
Sure. Sure. No, all I was saying is that a belief system is because you're saying, like, forget about the halakhic like rules.
Mm-hmm.
You're a Jew if you feel you're a Jew.
Right.
If you've got like Judaism in your heart, but again, all I'm saying is anybody could call you what you want. Whatever you've got in your heart is
right.
What you are. But
right.
But this concept of the religion is a hard one to grapple with,
mm-hmm.
because there are more than I would like to see many atheist Jews, agnostic Jews, Jews who would never step foot in a temple. Not because they're opposed to it. They just have no interest in going to synagogue or praying. It's not. But they love their matzo balls.
Right.
And, you know, you'll always see them, you know, spinning the dreidel and doing the things. They know that it's a part of their soul.
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend in the yoga community she's a generation older than we are. And that was like the great assimilation generation, where they really wanted to distance themselves from anything that made them different.
Right.
And I remember she said to me, because I mean, she does Seder, but I went to her Seder once, and let's just say it was dinner with a Jewish accent. I mean, I don't even know what it was, but she tries, but no connection to the zero connection to the religion. But what she said to me one time, as somebody who identifies so deeply as a Jewish woman and yet takes zero part in the religious, she's like, there's just something different about Jews. And you know, when you meet another Jew, that there's this connection that is ancient, that is unbreakable, and it's there just because. Mm-hmm. We're Mots. We're members of the tribe.
Wait, what was that word?
Mot.
I don't know that word. Mot.
Member of the tribe.
Oh, my. Okay. Now I got it.
Okay. So we talked a little bit before going on air, and I'm realizing just how much, because I'm 53. How old are you?
38.
Oh, okay. So
what was that reaction?
Because I'm so old.
Oh.
But I'm realizing like how much like intergenerational difference there is. And this is important too, because things are moving at such breakneck speed. Like when I was a kid, all Jews were Mots. That's what we called ourselves, the members of the tribe. You've never heard of it. I told you about, I had mentioned that you played Fiero, Wicked fans. You played Fiero on Broadway for a year, right? Oh, so
yeah,
we're
yeah, my Wicked poster is up. Is it on camera? Yeah.
Yeah, and I told him, wow, like you played Fiero and I drove a Fiero. And it was like, he's like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And I'm like, it's a car. He's like, what? And he thought I was making some Wicked reference. I'm like,
I thought you meant like you used to be someone's driver and you like one of the Fieros, some actor who played Fiero, you're like, oh, I used to drive a Fiero.
The most iconic car of the 80s and early 90s. And he like literally was like, and it was better that you said nobody's ever brought it up
no
to
one's
you.
No ever mentioned that I can recall.
So like I have a whole litany of, you know that you're getting old when.
Mm.
One of them is when you start every sentence with kids these days.
Oh.
But another one is when you sit down with a 38-year-old and try to make like cultural references.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. So let's just establish a fact. I'm old, you're young, let's move forward. It's great that we can be on the same page and from different generations.
Of course.
Oh. Okay. Let's talk about being Jewish.
Okay.
By the way, his podcast is not just called Being Jewish. It's the Being Jewish podcast with Jonah Platt. So when I say being Jewish, I literally mean, let's talk about being Jewish.
Right.
Okay. So on a scale of Jewish to super Jew, where are you and why?
I would say I'm like towards super Jew, but I'm not full super Jew. And like, this is something I talk about a lot too. So like, to me, being a super Jew is not about strictly like level of observance, how many of the, you know, laws and rituals you follow day to day. Obviously that's a big part of it, but what's more important is like, how much do you live by the principles? And like, I forget where this came up, but somebody dropped this idea in my mind. Like, who's to say that like keeping Shabbat counts more than bringing goodness into the world and, right, and doing those sorts of Jewish values? Like, sure, why is the, like, the ritual thing mean you're more Jewish than if I'm like the most generous person in the world, helping people on the street, whatever? Like, to me, that's extremely Jewish, that's right?
Jewish values.
So I feel like there are people who are embodying the spirit of being Jewish more than I am. I would never say, yep, I'm the number one super Jew. People who are more observant, more like in infused their whole day long, but I'm not too far off, because most of my day is in some way about me being Jewish.
Is that only since the podcast, or do you feel like it's defined your life from childhood, just recently?
It's definitely
10-7?
Like, it's been turned up. I would, okay, say it's like always been there. It's not like I was absolutely not connected and all of a sudden I found my Jewish, which is a lot of people,
sure,
which,
sure,
is a beautiful thing. For me, it was always a big part of my life. It had been only becoming more so as I hit sort of different phases. Like when I got married, it started to feel more important. When I started to have children, it got even more important, because, you know, now you're, sure, thinking about how am I building my life for my family? Like, what's going to be important to them? And so understanding how important being Jewish was to me with my wife and with my, as a father, definitely ramped it up even more for me.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I've been getting involved in Jewish advocacy stuff over the last 5 years, let's say. So it didn't just like click on.
Yeah.
But since October 7th, in terms of my day-to-day, you know, my day-to-day used to be, let's say, 80% career pursuit in entertainment, 20% Jewish stuff.
Right.
And now it's like 98% Jewish stuff, which is good. I mean, yeah, I'm happy.
It's been amazing. I would say that for me personally, granted, I mean, it's ironic. So I'm obviously deeply seated in the yoga world.
Right.
And the ironic thing is that one of the basic foundations of yoga is what's called Ishvara Pranidhana. And it's very similar to the first commandment, which is to submit to a higher power. Mm. And the beauty of yoga is it doesn't actually name that higher power. I'm talking about the original Yoga Sutra, like the original text. And so I think that when I found yoga, which was right before 9/11, 2001, I think that it brought me so much closer to my Judaism that that was when, I know you were in like diapers or something. Let's not talk about it.
I was in high school in 2001. Come on.
You were wearing diapers in high school?
I love yoga too, by the way.
Oh, okay.
I don't do it like a daily situation because I don't have the time, sadly.
Okay.
But I've done it, you know, hundreds of times.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Something else we have in common.
Yeah.
And we're both Jewish.
Hey, who knew?
So where I was going with that is that it astounds me to all end how many of my Jewish yoga, how many of my yoga counterparts consider themselves to be atheist. It makes me sad because it's supposed to be a cornerstone of this practice. So that being said, most people I know think I am literally the most religious person they know, which is so funny because...
Right. On the Jewish spectrum, there's so many people who are way more religious.
I'm talking about everybody. I'm talking about Christians, Muslims, anybody who knows me is like you, because you use this word a lot. I never use this word. I'm super Jewy. Like, my Judaism, like, absolutely defines me. And I try to live a life that would make the Jewish people proud. Mm-hmm. We have this, as Jewish people, this collective identity that I think no other people have, that... When Jeffrey Epstein does what he does, like, the whole Jewish community, it's a shanda, right? We have this word. We all know the word. It's a shanda. It's a shame upon, like, our whole nation, right? And we already have a bad enough PR my goal in life is to be such a good person that people say, wow, look at Shauna. She's a good person. She's really good at yoga. And she's a Jew, right? And I think that ultimately, like you said, that I think that being a good Jew is being a good person. Mm-hmm. And I used to go to a friend's house who's Chabad Lubavitch, like the ultra-Orthodox for Shabbat a lot. And they would have like Torah talk, right? Like, I mean, you know, like you can't just like talk about your day. You got to talk about important things. It's Shabbat and you do the things. And I remember one conversation ever, and I was probably there hundreds of times. Mm-hmm. And the question they asked was, is it better to do a mitzvah? It's funny, we call it a good deed, but really it means a commandment. Right. And again, that goes back to the concept of Judaism is not just do good deeds. You are commanded to do this 613 good deeds. But what the father like brought up was, sorry,
okay.
Hair all over.
Such long, luscious hair.
I know, and I always have to move it around because it's like, it annoys me. Was, is it better to do a mitzvah because it's commanded by God or because it's deep in your heart?
Right.
Now, as soon as he asked that, I knew I was going to be the only one at the table because I'm the only non-Lubavitcher there
right.
who was going to say...
Deep in your heart.
Exactly. Right. And I knew it. But I said it anyway because I say whatever I believe. That's who I am. But I think that's the difference between the religiosity of Judaism
yeah.
and the being Jewish. Because... till I go to my grave. And by the way, this goes back to Shvara Prana Dahana would say the same thing. Submit to a higher power. Do it because God says to do it. But I believe that what's in your heart and what's in your soul is so much more important than the mindless things that sometimes people do in the name of religion. Mm-hmm. It's so funny because this family was like a second family to me. And, oh, sorry. I have a bad habit of like flipping my hair.
Right.
It's so unpro. Anyway, so they're super religious. I'm super secular. And I would always ask them questions like, why do you do blah, blah, blah? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't understand this tradition. And you know what their answer basically always was?
The tradition.
And it was funny because eventually the wife wound up signing up for classes on Judaism so she could understand the traditions that she had been doing her whole life and never questioned. So to the super Jews.
You know, it's different for everybody. We're all working on different definitions of what God is, what it means to be an atheist, what it means to believe in a higher power. It's there's not like one thing that we've all agreed upon. So it just leaves a lot of room for variance. And if we can talk about it a little more, I think people would find that they may not be actually what they define themselves to be.
Sure. Sure. I have this argument a lot because I am somebody who absolutely believes in God, but at the same time, I guarantee it's not the God that a rabbi believes in.
Well,
not because it's not Jewish. Well, I believe God is everything that science has never been able to explain. God is in the miracles. God is everything. And I know that sounds silly, but like God is your pants. Not just God created your pants. We're all made up of the same exact matter. Mm-hmm. To me, all manifestations of existence, including nothingness and infinity, two concepts that are impossible for the human mind to actually grasp, are God. And even when people say like, oh, well, it all started with a big bang. I'm like, how does that disprove God? You went from nothing, a concept you can't understand, to something. That's God. So I don't think it's like, I don't think of a guy in the sky with a book and a pen and a...
Not every rabbi thinks that either.
Yeah.
You know, I had this woman on my podcast named Sarah Hurwitz.
Sure.
Who wrote this terrific book called Here All Along about all the Jewish wisdom. She talks about how, you know, most Jews either aren't don't know any of this stuff, or they stop learning at 13, you know, when Hebrew school ends. But like Jewish wisdom is this like rich, like amazing thing that has all these answers. It's like a lot of people who turn to yoga or Buddhism or self-help, whatever, because they're looking for answers. Like Judaism has a lot of them. And we just don't tend to go there because we don't know that it exists. And in her book, she defines like sort of the seven different types of God that Judaism sort of talks about. And different people believe in different versions of it. And some people think he's the dude on the throne, but I would bet most people don't.
So one thing that's so interesting about Judaism that I do believe is completely unique about us as a religion, I know we're going sort of back and forth between the religion and the ethnicity, is that Judaism is probably the only religion that says it's better to question God than to accept the concept blindly, because at least when you're questioning, you're seeking.
Right. You're in relationship.
Yeah. I often think that I don't get atheism, but I get agnosticism,
right,
which is, if in order to make that conscious decision to call yourself agnostic instead of atheist, it means you must be actively searching. Mm-hmm. And I give a lot of credit to that.
Yeah.
So if you could teach the world one thing about the Jewish people, what would it be?
What we've already discussed, and that's that Jews are a people. I think by far the biggest misunderstanding we have is that Jews are a bunch of white people who believe the same thing about God.
We're not white people?
Not, some of them are.
Who? Who's not white?
Oh, you know, the majority of Jews on planet Earth.
What?
Right?
So could you go into that? Because people say that, and I don't think any, like, they're like, oh, you mean like British white and French color and British color. Like people don't understand just how multicultural Jews are.
There's like two parts to that answer. One is that Jews, as I said, are a tribe. So like we are this people outside of the American idea of race. We preceded it by thousands of years. We exceed it by who we are. There are Chinese Jews. There are Indian Jews. There are African Jews. There are Moroccan Jews. There's Iraqi Jews. There's Syrian Jews. There's Argentinian Jews. There's, you know, Asian American Jews. There's every type of combo and country has Jews because we got kicked out of everywhere we've ever been and have been spread to the corners of the earth. So there are Jews from everywhere. And literally, the majority of the Jews on planet Earth are of Middle Eastern or North African descent, don't even present as white.
Sure. The original Jews are from Israel. I mean, that's Middle Eastern Jews. These are Mizrahi Jews. Like, we both belong to Sinai Temple. There's a massive amount of Persian Jews. These are not white people. These are Iranian people who have, you know, like a darker colored skin. And then we have
Some of them have light colored skin too.
Sure. We've got the Ethiopian Jews. Mm-hmm. We've got it. And we're not talking about converts. We're talking about actual like tribes that have propagated all over the world throughout the diaspora, but also of course in Israel, one of the most diverse nations out there.
Yeah. And so I think if people understood that, even if we didn't get to the racial part of it, that's my second biggest.
Okay.
Question. The number one is that it is a people, a tribe, and not, like I said, with Christianity, it's not something, oh, I believe this, so I'm a Jew. And if I stop believing it, I'm not a Jew anymore. No matter what you believe, if you're a member of the tribe, if you're a Mott, you're a Mott.
See, now you got a new word.
Yeah.
So if I could teach people one thing about the Jewish people, and I try to go to synagogue most Saturday mornings, particularly since 10/7, I've been a lot. And this strikes me every single time to the point where it makes me want to cry, that almost all Jewish liturgy is based on the concept of shalom, of peace. That I see imams online calling for the death of Jews. These are holy men. And our rabbis, it's not just our rabbis, we don't call for the death of anyone. we understand we have to defeat our enemies. That's a sad reality in life. War is necessary for peace. But all of our prayers are either about God or about peace. And when people mischaracterize us as, I'll use a nice word for a change, warmongers, the words that have been thrown at me have been so vile, but let's just say people who think that we are a violent people, at our core, nothing could be further from the truth.
Yeah.
And every Shabbat, I sit there and I'm like, I wish the world could just, well, they wouldn't understand the Hebrew. So maybe a Reformed congregation. I wish they could listen to any service in any synagogue anywhere on earth. And know that all we have ever wanted as Jews, all we have ever wanted is peace, hard stop.
Yeah.
And in order for us to have peace, our neighbors have to have peace. There's no such thing as one side having peace. So praying for peace for the Jewish people is honestly praying for peace for the world. So, okay. As the Jews, what's one thing you would like the world to know about Israel, the actual state of Israel, that makes you particularly proud?
Again, as we, it's already come up, it is like the most diverse place. It's certainly the most diverse place I've ever been in my life. I think it's, and I've been to countries all over the world. Again, people think it's like a bunch of white Europeans, and it's completely the opposite. Not only is it not all homogenous, it's unbelievably diverse. I mean, you get off the airplane or you walk on the Tayel at the beach in Tel Aviv, and you are surrounded by different ethnicities, people from different countries, different religions, old, young, friends, families, kids, grandparents, all looking different and all happy to be there and be living in that great society. And it's just a shame that that's not the Israel that people know because of propaganda. Propaganda works pretty well.
I just wanted to make sure the sound is working.
That would be a bummer.
Yeah. So clearly this ethnic piece is very, very important to you. And I think it makes Jewish people more relatable if people can understand it.
Well, it's not understanding it is what opens the door for so much of the hate. That's why it's so important to me. Because if you're just a religion, then it's like, well, why do you need this? Why do you need that? Why are you, I'm not a racist if I'm talking about your religion. Why do you need a country if you're just a religion? And, you know, oh, you guys are all white Europeans. You're all colonizers. You're all, everybody's wealthy. Everybody's powerful. It's like, it allows you to just dump all these tropes and prejudices that are just simply not true. They're just literally not based on reality.
I think that for me, I go to Israel often, 2 or 3 times a year.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I'm jealous.
I know. I went twice last year, which was amazing. Yeah. Once on a mission and once to volunteer. Cool. I'm going back in August. It's been too long. I can't wait because like my soul just lives there.
Yeah.
So
would you ever make Aliyah?
That's actually one of the questions I was going to ask you. The answer is I'm in the process of trying to figure it out.
Really?
It's not as simple as all that.
Why?
My little sister lives in Tel Aviv, but my family lives here. I have a house with an insane mortgage, like a really, really like 1.9%.
Oh, like an insane good.
Yeah, insanely good. So it's really hard to let that go.
I don't know
if
you meant like the process of like immigrating would be as hard.
No, it's just extracting your life.
Yeah, of course.
In having a job.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, the thing that is frustrating about Israel as a yoga instructor is that the pay rate for private instructors in Tel Aviv is a quarter of what it is here.
I mean, that's a lot of the economics there. It's, you know, it's harder to...
The expenses are twice as high, right?
The expenses are high, and it's not there's not a lot of multi-millionaires in
Israel. Oh, yes, there are. But you have to be in tech.
It's much, much harder to make that kind of a living there than it is here.
Yeah. So putting the actual logistics together is challenging, but my heart yearns for Zion. How cheesy is that? Mm-hmm. It does, though. But I think that the one thing that I wish the world understood about Israel is that this is a nation that does the right thing, even when no one's looking. Even when the world is, I mean, the amount of vitriol that we get, even from all international bodies, we might as well not try to save Palestinian lives.
Right.
We might as well not give them aid. We might as well not do all we, Israel, do all the things that we have done to make this, for example, this war, for example, and this is not a unique war this way, the lowest civilian casualty rates of any urban warfare in history, and lower than most wars, even outside of urban warfare, even outside the insanely complex conditions of fighting a terrorist that's living beneath its own civilian infrastructure and using them as human shields. And even if the world can't see that, Israel continues to do the right thing. And when they make a mistake, they take full accountability for it.
Most of the time.
When's the last time Hamas took accountability other than being proud
that
they do?
Everything you said is right, but what's important, it's like Israel is certainly like no worse than 100 other countries in the world and better than a lot of them. It makes mistakes like
sure.
All countries do. It has issues like all countries do. Some politicians are better than others, as all politicians in all countries are. It's got this crazy like microscope on it where it's
yes.
held to these insane standards
that nobody else
that
is
no
held
one else
to.
Has to ever do. And as you're saying, like even under that, like they're punching it way above average in terms of like doing things the right way and getting things right and coming from good intention.
Sure.
So, you know, I feel like it's important to note, it's like they're a country like any other country, and like all countries on earth, some are better than others in terms of, you know, doing the right thing. And Israel is one of those, even if it's not 100% of the time. But no one is 100%
of the time. Of course. Nobody is 100%.
Yeah. But people are like, I think they expect Israel. It's either like you're 100% or you're the worst country on earth.
Right. But even like Israel, right, who shows up even in enemy territory,
yeah,
even mm-hmm. in Turkey, even in, you know, like all sorts of places they have, even in Syria, mm-hmm. even in places where the population is their avowed enemies, they show up to help.
That's a Jewish value. It's actually part of this week's Parsha.
What's this week's Parsha?
Mishpatim, which I've actually just started. I'm going to sound like I'm so much more learned than I am. I was inspired by that guest, Sarah Hurwitz,
yeah.
to like start reading about the Parsha each week, just like
nice.
Bringing a little bit of Jewish study into my
Beautiful.
Life. And like one of the things it talks about is even if someone's your enemy, and they mean this on a person to person level, not
mm-hmm.
like a country to country trying
sure,
to destroy level.
Sure.
But even if somebody is your enemy and they have a donkey and the donkey is like burdened by weight and the donkey is struggling, you go over and help them. A, because Jews care about animals. Like, that's a Jewish value. You take care
yeah.
of animals. And B, like, even if he's your enemy, if he needs help in that moment, you go and you help him solve this problem and you support him in that. And, I mean, that's a core Jewish value.
Yeah. So, there's just so much misunderstanding. And some of it, I think, is deliberately unwilling to acknowledge that we are good people, because that creates real problems for our enemies. So I want to talk a little bit about your family.
Okay.
So one of my favorite parts of synagogue, right, is when we sing L'dor V'dor, which means mm-hmm. from generation to generation, we all put our arms around each other
I
and
love
we
that
sway.
One too.
And from generation to generation, I would say, is like the primary theme at Sinai Temple. They choose a lot of prayers that have that that message. And I believe it says it on the outside of the building, too. But So your mom, right? Like, she's been the head of or on the board of basically every single major Jewish organization or initiative, like, in America. That's yeah. quite a legacy.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, does your family legacy of supporting the Jewish people, of supporting Israel, go beyond your mom? Was this something that she created herself? Like, how is your family's broader, intergenerational? If we could talk about your grandparents, if you know about your great-grandparents, and how you're bringing up your children from Lador Vador, how's this unfolding for you?
It's definitely an inherited value that, like, it did not start with my mom. So, like, just to put into perspective, like, both on my mom's side and my dad's side, like, all of my aunts and uncles basically have led a federation or a Jewish organization or something. Amazing. And been involved at one time or the other in different cities all around the country. At one point, my mom was head of LA Federation. Her sister was head of New York Federation at the exact same time. And it starts from their parents. My grandparents were all involved in their Jewish communities and leaders in the community. And I don't know much about my great-grandparents on my dad's side. I know that my great-grandparents on my mom's side were, you know, Judaism was incredibly important to them. They came over at the beginning of the 20th century from Latvia. And, you know, they, like, started the first synagogue in Marietta, Ohio, which is now gone because there's not enough Jews there to have one. Oh. But they had it for a while. And it's always been, like, part of the family. And it's continued through my parents' generation to my generation. I have cousins who are all heavily involved in their Jewish communities. My sister, you know, worked for Camp Ramah for many, many years. Okay. And
Go to Ramah?
I did.
I went to Ramah.
In Ohio?
Yeah.
Oh, right on. Yeah, me too. So did my mom and all her cousins and siblings.
Okay.
And all of my cousins and siblings when we all got to be there together, which is nice. Amazing. I was just in New York for an event with New York UJA, and my cousin Ellie, who's very involved there, she interviewed me because she's, like, one of their young leaders.
Beautiful.
Which was amazing. Yeah. So it's really, it's a family thing that we've all been lucky to have great role models.
And, right.
And now we're all doing our part.
Yeah. How many of your, or how far back, how many generations back, your first, like, ancestors or whatever came in the 20th century, or do you have people prior to that? Or
as far as I know, no. Like, we, that, like, my people have been in America only since the early 1900s.
That's okay. So pre-World War II.
Oh, definitely pre-World War II.
Got it.
Very luckily on both sides, yep. Everyone was here before the Holocaust.
Okay. Same with me. All of my grandparents are American born. Older than yours.
Yes. All of my grandparents are American born.
Yeah. But only one of my great-grandparents, who was born around 1885, is American born. The other three great-great-grandparents came from, you know, Russia, Poland.
Yeah, Russia. I think all my great-grandparents are foreign born.
Yeah. Yeah. My grandfather, my mother's father in particular, was a very, very proud Jew and a proud, like, Israel supporter. And I mean, my mom would tell me about how her grandfather, my great grandfather, his biggest wish in life was to take her to Eretz Israel. She was 4 when it was founded. So she definitely grew up with that value. And my grandfather always heading, like, the annual fund for Israel. And my mom was the head of, back then it was called UJA, wasn't it?
Yeah, in New York, it's still called
UJA. Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. We were in New York.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought that was, like, had turned into federation. She was head of our local UJA, and in, you know, she's been very involved with AIPAC with me. And so I would say that, like, my matri lineage has been, like, my primary inspiration for my Jewish advocacy and my Jewish roots. I'm so grateful for that. I don't know that most people find it on their own. I think you have to have that as a family value, whether it's Judaism or the support of Israel, in order to really grow into that. Even if the seed was planted many years ago, it takes a while sometimes to germinate.
Yeah, I mean, we all, I feel like in life, if it's not our parents, it's, you know, something else. But, like, we all need role models to do the things we do, who, you know, show us the path. But, you know, there's plenty of people who were not even born Jewish who are holding jobs in the Jewish world and working at Jewish foundations and things like that. So that, you know, maybe their parents modeled for them caring about the community or being a leader or, you know, caring about, you know, giving back, whatever. And that's how it's manifested itself. But it's, you know, I think there's a lot of different ways in.
So I think I know the answer to this question, but outside of your family, who would you say has been your biggest role model to influence you as a Jew, as a Jewish man? Maybe I don't know the answer.
Well, what were you going to say? What do you think the answer is?
I think it's Rabbi Wolpe.
It's not Rabbi Wolpe, and which is not a knock on Rabbi Wolpe. I love Rabbi Wolpe. He's been my lifelong rabbi. Yeah. But it's not like, oh, because of my rabbi, I'm XYZ.
Because you or he told the story about that you would take walks. Yeah, and
I was always, you know, questioning everything.
Right.
And he was so like, again, this is no slam on Rabbi Wolpe in any way. Who's a book right over there? Three of them on that shelf.
Yeah.
But
I do have to note what an amazing library you have of Jewish literature here too, and other literature.
I'm working on it. It's certainly grown in the past couple of years.
Nice.
I would say, you know, I've been really inspired by the cohort that I met through the Tel Aviv Institute, which is an organization started by a guy named Chen Mazig, who's an incredible Jewish advocate online. Right. And being in community with these different people through that, who are all in different places and different professions, but are all just sort of looking for how to be Jewish loudly and proudly in their different worlds,
right,
is inspiring to me.
I love that. Mm-hmm. Okay, well then I guess it doesn't make my answer as redundant as I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
Because mine is Rabbi Wolpe, actually.
I mean, he's got a lot of wisdom, that guy.
He's not just got wisdom, but his passion for the Jewish state is remarkable. Mm-hmm. And so I remember when he became a rabbi at Sinai Temple and he started Friday Night Live, which mm-hmm. at the time was a revolution. Now everybody does it,
right.
Which is like rock and roll Shabbat for young people.
Right.
And that he really instilled in me as this, you know, young starry-eyed Jewess in the pews, you know, like how important Israel was, not just Judaism. Mm. And he talked a lot about AIPAC, and it's because of him that I became very, very involved in AIPAC around the turn of the century. And then once I got involved with AIPAC, I mean, it snowballed from there. I got involved with everything, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so I'm on the National Women's Board for Israel Bonds. I was a speaker for ADL, for Stand With Us. I write for the Times of Israel blogs. I'm in the Jewish Diplomatic Corps of the World Jewish Congress. Like, I just, wherever I have an opportunity, I seize it. And I have to say that he was my inspiration.
Wow. It's amazing.
Yeah. And I did not grow up with him the way you did.
Right.
I was introduced to him. I guess it was about the same time, going back to the fact that I'm 100 years older than you are.
Okay.
But I didn't know him personally back then. I was just, you know, from afar, like just taking it all in, his mm-hmm. brilliance and just how inspiring he is.
Yeah.
So you did go to Sinai Akiba. So you went to Jewish day school.
Mm-hmm.
How would you say your education path has helped to take you? And you could go all the way through college. And you could talk about what you're doing now. You're still on your education path,
right,
which is amazing. And again, now you're inspiring me to hopefully do the same. But from preschool on, like, how would you say Jewish education, or even if there was some non-Jewish education, how did it help to define you?
So on the Jewish piece, I would say there's like two answers to that. One is, being in Jewish day school, it just, you can't help but develop a sense of Jewish identity. Yeah. So, and like a high level of Jewish literacy. So like by the time I graduated Sinai, I knew all the prayers. I knew how to wrap tefillin. I knew how to wear tallit. I knew all the holidays. I knew all about Israel. I knew all the things, sort of like the starter pack of like being a Jew. I had all that by the, you know, by the time I was 13 and then some.
Right.
That it, to me is the best and most important part of Jewish day school. And values, you know, Jewish values, a school that's run according to those values and is prioritizing those values in how they're thinking about everything and building community. It's such a communal experience being in a Jewish day school. It's different. It's very different than, you know, going to public school where you sort of drop your kids off and then pick them up at the end of the day. With a Jewish day school, there's a lot more room for involvement and partnership. So that was super important. And in terms of like, there's a lot of education I didn't get that I wish I would have gotten. It's hard to know how much you can give to a 13-year-old, but like, I don't feel like I got into the depths of Jewish wisdom. I don't think I got a great understanding of current events in regards mm-hmm. to Jews or mm-hmm. Israel. Mm-hmm. Things that I know are being remedied now.
Right.
In day schools where they're sort of realizing, oh, we kind of skipped some
Drop
stuff.
Drop the ball on that. Yeah.
Clearly we need to be arming our young people with this information about identity, about why is Israel, not just Israel's important because it's the homeland of the Jews, but like, why is that so important? What does that mean? Really digging into Jewish history, not just biblical history, mm-hmm. but like I didn't get any recent Jewish history.
Right.
It was all like, let's learn about the, you know, tribe of Benjamin, which is like, okay, great.
Right.
But I was like,
right.
I mean, I didn't really retain that. So, you know, there's some work to be done. But again, it's also, you know, you're 10, 11, 12, 13.
Right.
So I don't know how deep you can go on that stuff, but I would have liked a little more of it. And I also did not leave with Hebrew as a language skill in a way that I wish
Interesting.
I would have, which they're way, like my son knows more Hebrew than I do and he's 5. He's amazing.
Well, kids pick up language a lot easier.
But it's like just the volume and it's like they're teaching it the way you're supposed to teach language.
Immersion.
Like his teacher speaks to them in Hebrew.
Sure.
It's amazing.
And then where'd you go after high school?
I went to non-Jewish school
right.
for high school. I basically kind of stopped my Jewish education, but I went to Vermont as we talked about.
Right.
So still every summer I was getting immersed in it again and learning even more. Going deeper on certain things and just sort of continuing to build that Jewish identity, which you're not like aware of while it's happening.
Right.
You're not like, oh, I'm going to camp to like feel more Jewish. It just happens because, you know, there's Hebrew writing on the walls and you're doing Israeli dances and, you know, everything is infused again with those Jewish values.
Yeah.
And it's just like by osmosis, it's filling you up. So I was getting more of it through that. And then at that point, it was like a part of me. So, you know, when I went to college, like I took a class on some Jewish Holocaust literature class and I got involved with a rabbi there who I still talk to, who's great. And like did a program with him.
Okay.
I was like looking for touch point. I was not like a Hillel guy.
Right.
I didn't spend a lot of time there.
Yeah.
But I was, it's like never not part of who I am.
Right.
And as you mentioned, now I'm getting a master's online in anti-Semitism studies.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I had a little bit, I think of an interesting education path when it came to Judaism, because of course I went to Jewish preschool, right? Because that's what you do, right?
Because
that's never going to be a part of like school.
Mm-hmm.
In first grade, I went to Mount St. Mary's. Because it was the best school in the area where I lived in. And like a third of the kids there were Jewish. In fact, they had what was called SSR, sustained silent reading. So when they studied Bible, they would let all the Jewish kids like read books, right? Which was amazing that
that's,
they didn't,
that's very
you know, that
inclusive.
They made that
that's
accommodation.
Yeah.
But then my parents found, this was in upstate New York, a tiny little Jewish school, day school in like Poughkeepsie that we had to drive like an hour and a half to get to every day. I might be making that up. I have no idea how far it was. It wasn't close.
Far.
And we went there, I mean, classes of, you know, just handfuls of people who are my friends on Facebook now, which is funny because I moved to California after third grade. And then I went to Lubavitch School. Again, it was the only Jewish school in Orange County at the time here in California, which is amazing because now the number one, like literally has been named like the number one private school in America, not just Jewish.
Wow.
Private, not that. Tarbut V'Torah, which is in Irvine, which is where I actually grew up. It would have been nice to have gone there instead. But it was funny because it sounds like quite contrary to what you experienced. I did come out speaking Hebrew. Wow. We had read the entire Torah, including the Rashis, which was amazing. That was my favorite part. Rashi is like a commentator who speaks about like the Bible codes, and it's very amazing stuff. And I came out of there. Okay, you're going to get this, but or hopefully you'll get that. You won't get this. Never mind. You never went to Gan Israel. You only went to, so Gan Israel, which is like the Lubavitch camps. We had the army of Hashem. And we were like, Hashem is like the name for God. It's an unspoken name of God. And the army of Hashem had nothing to do with war. It was just like, you know, like we're like his, we're his people, like we're his tribe. And so I came out of school, like in the army of Hashem. My rabbi did not show up for my bat mitzvah. He was sick or something. And he didn't even send like anyone. I did the whole thing.
That's not nice.
It was funny though, because I mean, I knew the prayers inside, outside, upside down. The Torah portion was nothing for me. The Haftorah, I'm just like, blah, blah, blah. Like now everyone divides it up. Like they read one portion. Like we, like I was like, blah, 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 blah. Like, and then after my bat mitzvah, nothing. I just didn't want any part of it. Not because I hated Judaism. I was one of, I think that in Irvine in the 80s, we were about 2%.
Yeah.
Now it's very high. Well, not very high, but significant. And I didn't want to be that Jewish guy. I already had the weird name. Right. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And growing up in sports, the fact that everyone was already playing and I had to be dropped off by like the rabbi bus to go to sports with all the kids who were like, who's that weird kid? When I got into normal school, public school, I'm like, I just want to be normal. And I'm going to study French now instead of Hebrew. And I'm going to do all the things. And then, so you're a UPenn family. We're a Cornell family. And we go deep like you guys go deep. And I went to Cornell. And back then, it was probably about one third Jewish. I mean, it was massively Jewish. And then I realized this is what I've been missing. Mm-hmm. I did go to summer camp, but in my everyday life in Irvine, none of my friends was Jewish. None of the people around me other than my family was Jewish. I was so embarrassed if someone came to my house for Shabbat and, you know, we had to light the candles and do the bread. And I'm like, okay, so we're going to, you know, like, and it was, I'm not going to say a point of shame, but I wouldn't say that I like was like the proudest of Jews in that era. Mm-hmm. Cornell like reminded me what it meant to be in an actual Jewish community. Meaning just people who are being Jewish, like they, just being Jewish, right? Not religious, just Jewish, right? And my first Jewish advocacy was my senior year. The Cornell Daily Sun allowed an advertiser, Bradley Smith, I remember his name, to take out a full page Holocaust denial info. Well, it was an article. Like it looked like an article. It looked super legitimate. And you're just reading the Cornell Daily Sun. You're like, oh, there was never a Holocaust. And the fact that Cornell had accepted money for this and allowed it and printed it in our daily paper, that was the first time that I encountered real anti-Semitism in my life. And I was confounded.
Yeah.
Like I'm like, what the heck is this? And I have to say there was a big protest and there was no one like defending it. My, how things have changed. But that was sort of like my entry into understanding that maybe the world isn't as benevolent as we think it is.
Yeah.
Maybe it is. So after school, I went into Hollywood like you did.
Mm-hmm.
And as we discussed, I used to talk to your father like almost every day, which is so funny.
Yeah.
But that was a return to a Jewish community. And this is one of the tropes, right? Jews control Hollywood. I see you looking at your phone, so I assume you have to end soon.
Oh, no, I was just checking on the time.
Right. Did you have to end soon?
Ish.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So it was interesting because, again, we're talking about early 90s, but back then, if you weren't Jewish, you were an honorary Jew. Like, so.
What do you mean?
I will never forget, we had this one client who was, I was at ICM at the time, who was like this famous Black actor. And he was like very into using a lot of like Yiddish with us and like throwing in the, I understand you, I get you, we're mm-hmm. all the same, you know. And it was a sense of belonging. It wasn't anything manipulative. It was just, you know, we all sort of spoke the same language. And I think that people don't understand that it's not that Jews control Hollywood. It's that Jews created Hollywood. And that the arts have always been so important to us. And they've been, honestly, a tool for getting through the most difficult parts of history, right? Through music, through comedy. I mean, we've got MGM, Warner Brothers. Like, these were studios founded by Jewish people. So it's not a coincidence, nor is it a conspiracy, that there are so many Jews in Hollywood. Back then, it felt Jewish. I've been out of it for so long. I'm curious, what is your sense of the Jewish or lack of Jewish nature in Hollywood now? Because what I hear is terrible, but you're on the inside.
A couple of different things. One is, like, we actually don't know how many Jews work in Hollywood. There's no study. There's no data. There's no statistics. For all we know, it's 10%. Like, literally, we have no idea. And it's a large industry, and it's just sort of accepted as a fact that everybody's Jewish. They're not. I mean, they're not. I would say there are still, obviously, as you mentioned, a lot of Jews in Hollywood, because it's always been, that's part of the Jewish culture. It's like, why are there a lot of, you know, Asians in tech? It's just like part of the culture that Jews gravitate to the arts. Everywhere they've ever been, they've been supporters and participants in the arts in every single country Jews have ever lived. So there's that piece. There's also a lot of people, like, just because you say a word in Yiddish doesn't make you a connected Jew. So I think a lot of the Jews in Hollywood are actually not representative of the Jewish community. They're very disconnected. And unfortunately, a lot of these are gatekeepers,
mm-hmm.
and they're not, you know, behaving as leaders or members of the Jewish community in the way that they're making decisions. Quite the opposite. It's about, you know, teenage Shauna being like, I just want to be like everyone else. I already have this name. I don't want people to see me as Jewish at all.
Right.
And we have a lot of those people in Hollywood. So even if there are technically a lot of Jews in Hollywood, there's a lot of people who are Jewish and working almost against the Jewish community in Hollywood because they're so desperate to be assimilated and not seen as Jewish.
But they do show up for High Holy Day services to schmooze.
Maybe. Sure. And, you know, again, I'm not generalizing.
Right.
So this is not everybody. And there are plenty of very connected, very active Jews in entertainment, as there are in a lot of industries. And I've seen even more of that since October 7th, people who sort of have woken up a little bit and are not wanting to lay low like they were before because they see, you know, the situation we're in. But for every one of those, there's still a Jew who will say, oh, I'm culturally Jewish. But what that really means to them is they go to High Holidays once a year and say mishpacha when they talk on the phone,
right.
and are not involved with anything else Jewishly and not doing anything for the benefit of the community.
Yeah, I agree with you. I know we need to wind this down, and I'm hoping maybe we could have another conversation at a later date, more specific to 10/7 and how it's affected you and how it's changed things for you. But I just want to touch really quickly upon that about the advocacy piece. it was supposed to be what I wanted to talk about in the first place, but this has been way more enjoyable.
Good.
Just going back to your podcast for a second.
Yeah.
How do you feel like your podcast is making a difference in this world?
Honestly, because people are telling me it is. That's the truth. It's a great thing to know what I thought it was going to do and hoped it would do. It's doing. I mean, I just got a text message or not a, a DM yesterday that I sent out to the whole team of someone saying like, please tell the whole Being Jewish team how much the show means to me, how important the work you guys are doing, how you know, makes me feel less alone. I feel like I have a home. Like stuff like that is amazing. It's so satisfying and motivating to know how much it's helping people. Yeah. Really, it's such a hard time for Jews right now, and to be able to provide a place of comfort and community and information and just food for thought is, you know, a privilege, and I really am just happy that it's happening.
It has been. I agree. Such an honor and a privilege to be able to be a part of the greater voice, because I think that what I don't think, I know what happens because I hear it all day, is people now are either afraid to speak up, but let's put them aside for a second because that's a conversation for another day. Yeah. But what I hear more than anything is like, I only have, you know, my family on my feed, or I only have, you know, 10 followers, you know, like it doesn't make any difference if I talk. And I'm like, you know what? If 100 of you talk, we have 100 more voices. And if 1,000,000 of you talk, we have 1,000,000 more voices. And the fact that people aren't talking, like people don't understand that, just like the butterfly effect, the words that you say, you might have one line in a podcast where somebody's listening with one ear while working and they're like, oh my goodness, that's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then they repeat it to their friends, and they repeat it to their family, and they and eventually people start waking up. But again, I don't want to get into the silence is complicity and all the things, because it actually is, and I do believe that. But silence doesn't accomplish anything, even if you have the best of intentions.
Mm-hmm.
And you have proven that just taking a voice and putting it out there makes a difference. And I hope that people, whether it means maybe they start their own podcast and five people listen, maybe they repost your podcast or my podcast, or
I think it's a really important point to make sure people understand that you don't need a podcast. Like you don't need to have a big voice on social media to have a voice. It can be in your workplace. It
That's
can
right.
be on your group chat. It can be in line at the grocery store. Like wherever you are and whatever your lane is in life, we need you to be a vocal, present, proud Jewish person in this moment. And I want to take that responsibility. A lot of people will be like, well, I can't have a podcast. I only have 10 followers.
Sure.
There's 1,000,000 ways you can make a difference.
Okay. Course.
Start a fundraiser for your workplace. I mean, there's just like, it's endless.
Yeah.
It's not just about being a public facing figure. There's just, we need everybody to show up however and wherever they can.
And the ironic thing about social media is if you have whatever, an Instagram account with one follower and you just repost other people, it helps the algorithm. Even if no one sees it, you are amplifying a voice because the algorithm's like, oh, these people forwarded it. It must be good. So even something as simple as posting on a profile that nobody else sees even helps.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's all about the algorithm.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. I always like to add on a good note. So as the great statesman Abba Ibn said, Jews love our clouds without the silver lining. However,
Jews love our clouds without the silver lining.
We like to kvetch.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
We do. We like to kvetch.
Okay.
However, every single cloud has a silver lining. Even this horrifically dark cloud that has formed and grown since 10/7.
Mm-hmm.
What is the silver lining for you?
I have a lot of silver linings. I mean, really, we're seeing the emergence of a Jewish renaissance in a lot of ways, of people who are suddenly awakened and galvanized and creating new initiatives and new works of art and new everything and new connections, you know, people who would never have enrolled their kids in day school are now banging down the door to get their kids in, stuff like that, is amazing to see. And another silver lining is, you know, getting to meet people like you, all these people who have shown up who are now doing the work together. I've met a lot of amazing people and made a lot of new friends. And it's a great comfort to be, you know, in the trenches with all these other awesome people.
Agree. Galvanize is actually the word that I wrote.
Damn.
So I may be old, but we have the same words sometimes. But I think about like my nephews, for example, a perfect example. So my niece and nephew, who are my sister's children, who were brought up quite Jewish. My three nephews were brought up only peripherally Jewish, meaning they come to the family events right. and it is what it is. Mm-hmm. So three of my nephews just pledged AAPI. And these kids are, they're athletes, they're gorgeous. I'm not just saying this. Like mm-hmm. they are like the popular kids in school. They're not nerds, they're not peripheral. They are in it to win it, and they chose a Jewish fraternity, which is like blowing all our minds in the best possible way. They're all wearing Magen Davids or a mezuzah. One of my nephews is like, he has a rock band that it's been outsized success for how young, like they've been cool. at the House of Blues. They've been at the Whiskey. They've That's been awesome. At all as high schoolers, but he's in college.
I did that too.
Yeah. Yeah. But he has like a star, like bigger than yours. Nice. And he's like on stage and he's just right. And nobody else in his band, I don't think, is Jewish, but it's just so ingrained in who he is.
I love that.
And the Jewish unity has been extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to change the Jewish world forever.
No doubt.
Just like you are.
Oh. We're all trying. We all got it. It's an all hands on deck moment. So we're all doing what we can.
Jonah, thank you so much for joining me. This has been such a pleasure to connect. The funny thing is, this is not the direction that I expected the conversation to go in okay. at all, right? My intro is all like, anti-Semitism is everywhere, Ted 7, and instead, like, you have the ruach, you have the soul that brings out, like, the joy and the yeah. excitement of being Jewish. That's so right. thank you for being Jewish with me.
You got it. Anytime.
Thanks you guys for joining. In a super pro moment, I'm going to reach out and touch my phone to turn off the feed. This is Shauna Meyerson and Jonah Platt. And hey, Am Yisrael Chai.
Am Yisrael Chai.